tonight on Arena. Mona O'Gourke, Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack with the tales of 19th century Irish immigrant women, and live music from David Kitt and his new album, Idiot Check. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Now, I don't know if it qualifies as a Saturn return, but it is nice to be back in the seat, and thanks to Kev for looking after things last week while I had a little Easter break. The 38th Cúirt International Festival of Literature opens tomorrow in Galway and runs all week. Among the highlights is an event called Telling Tales, Irish Emigrant Women in the 19th Century. It'll be chaired by the author Nuala O'Connor. Three writers are on the panel. Poet Mona O'Gourke, whose last collection is Hereafter, The Telling Life of Ellen O'Hara. And Mona is joined by historians Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack, who'll be talking about their non-fiction book, Bad Bridget, Crime, Mayhem and the Lives of Irish Emigrant Women. Delighted that Mona joins us now from our Galway studios, and Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack are in Belfast. I'll go to you first of all, if I can, Leanne. Just on the history side of this, how big a phenomenon, how big an issue is Irish immigrant women, their particular emigration in the 19th century?
Well, emigration, as I suppose we all know, was huge from Ireland in the 19th century. And for women, sometimes the story of women and female emigration is often forgotten and subsumed with the male stories. And really, by the time we get to the middle of the 19th century, about half of all immigrants leaving Ireland were women and going to North America. And by the 1880s and 1890s, women were outnumbering men. And one of the interesting things about Irish female emigration is that women often left, they were very young. Our youngest immigrant is 7, travelling unaccompanied across the Atlantic. They were unmarried. And this was very different in a European context, when most women who emigrated as part of a family group. So the scale was huge. And also the importance for both families back at home was also huge, too, in terms of money coming back into the country as well.
And Elaine, were the same driving factors as were there for other immigration, in that a lot of emigration was for economic reasons that people left home? Was that predominantly the case across those who of the female gender who emigrated at the time as well?
Yes, you're completely right. We see this coming up again and again in the records that we've gone through. When women come into the prisons, they're asked, you know, why they had come to North America in the first place, and the vast majority are saying it's to work. They're looking for jobs. I suppose there was a bit of a sense that they could step into jobs as domestic servants, maybe a little bit more easily than they could in Ireland. I suppose for women as well, or for girls, there's also a bit of an expectation that they will get a job and that they will send money home. So there's that kind of perception that the girls are a better bet than the boys, that they'll send the money back to their families. And, you know, many of these families at home are dependent on those individuals who are migrating, getting set up very, very quickly and being in a position to fund their own survival in North America, but also to fund the survival of those relatives left behind in Ireland.
And domestic service is very much, or was very much, part of the story that you told, Mona O'Gourke, in your recent collection Hereafter, The Telling Life of Ellen O'Hara. And I remember we spoke about this, and she's one of my favourite fictional stroke factual stroke is she real at all characters of the last 12 or 18 months or so. You might just explain who Ellen O'Hara is or was, how real she is, how invented she is.
Okay, well, Anne Ellen O'Hara was my great-grandmother. And I set about writing this book when I was in New York. And I just thought one day, well, let me see what I can find out about her. And the answer is not very much. Because if you're going for the kind of young Irish girl who got a job as a domestic servant or worked in a mill, which were the two main occupations, then they're not going to show up in the kind of records that Elaine and Leanne were using. Mm. So they'll show up in census records and they'll show up on passenger lists for immigration records. And maybe they might show up in Polk's directory if they go on to set up little boarding houses, which my Ellen O'Hara did. But they don't really show up very much. So in order to tell her story, I had to kind of add imagination to the mix of the few facts that I was able to locate about her.
And one of my favourite bits of imagination that you added was, I'm still not sure whether it actually happened to you or whether you conjured her up in your mind, but as you were writing this, she entered the room fairly regularly on a daily basis, perhaps in your imagination, perhaps in reality, I'm not sure, and had good long conversations with you about the time she spent in the States.
Well, I'm glad that she was so articulate, because otherwise I wouldn't have had anything to put in the book at all. But one of the things I discovered pretty quickly, and to be honest, I don't know, did this come out of my head or did it come out of books I was reading about these young women? But I decided pretty quickly that she was going to be a cheeky young one and that she was going to push back against me, and she wasn't going to let me have my own way in terms of getting her to yield up all the facts that I wanted to get from her. So I had her just sort of, you know, caution me and be wary of me and criticise me and mock me. And of course, that was much more fun for me to write than if she had just been a kind of a patsy giving me everything I wanted.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
I'm sure Elaine and Leanne are there thinking, God, it's shocking easy to be a fiction or a writer of fiction and poem. You can make up anything you want and just say that it happened in my imagination. But Leanne, I suppose, Vona brings up a serious point there. I mean, I think it was Elaine that mentioned the idea of going through the records that you went through to find the various stories that you found for Bad Bridget. How difficult is it to find material outside of census records, maybe ship listings, things like that? Where did you go to find details on these women?
Well, actually, you know, we have a huge amount of material on our Bad Bridgets, because these are women who often came to the attention of the authorities, right, for all the wrong reasons. So we've got prison registers, we've got arrests, we've got the records relating to charitable institutions, we've got those sort of societies who were looking after the protection of children or were investigating families. So from a range of sources, we've been able to identify the thousands of Irish women who were ending up in prisons and coming to the attention of the authorities. And then we're also able to follow those up in newspapers and find out more about their stories there as well. So it's building, again, you know, pictures from lots of different stories, but trying to find out the examples that we can from records, whether it's relating to the courts as well. And we've come across, you know, one of my favourite Bad Bridgets is a woman called Marion Canning, and we know about her because her father wrote letters to the judge in her court case and also to the governor of New York. So we've got those and things called pardon files. So again, lots of different trawling the archives and trying to find all sorts of ways to find out a bit more information about our women.
And I suppose, Elaine, I'll go to you on this. Maybe tell me a little bit more about Marion Canning, because I'm interested in that title, Bad Bridgets. To what extent were they Bad Bridgets, or to what extent were they told they were Bad Bridgets and thrown into a prison and became Bad Bridgets as a result of being incarcerated, I suppose, in some ways? Do you know what I'm getting at here? To what extent, how bad were they or how bad were they presumed to be?
Yes, so some of them I definitely wouldn't want to meet on a dark night. But in our whole study, we can see such a wide range. We see some of these girls and women are most definitely victims. They're victims of circumstances. They're victims of discrimination. The case that Leanne has mentioned of Marion Canning, who ends up defending herself in court. She doesn't really know how the system is working and ends up in prison, charged with what ultimately turns out to be a crime that she didn't commit, convicted of the crime. But we do also see these girls and women as agents. And I think it's important to acknowledge that some of them are making a very deliberate decision to get involved in criminal behaviour and that they see this as profitable. So we have one woman, Maud Merrill, who's working in the sex industry, and her sister pleads with her. This is in the 1860s, and her sister pleads with her to leave, that this is, you know, this is casting a bit of a stigma on the family reputation. And Maud says, oh yes, I will, but you know, after Christmas, I can't leave now. So she's making a very deliberate economic decision there to remain in the sex industry, to be committing these crimes. And we see that coming up again and again with women who are involved in department store theft. Another woman, Elizabeth Dillon, she's known as Queen of Dips, and she actually targets funerals. So she dresses herself in black. She says nobody suspects somebody who cries well of being a thief. So she's targeting these, you know, bereaved women predominantly at these funerals. She's making a very deliberate decision there to be involved in criminal behaviour. And for her, she sees it as profitable.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit like the 19th century version of The Wedding Guests, that film that has the two lads that keep they crash the weddings and then, you know, have a good party and a good time, if such can be had. Although it is interesting in what both Leanne and Elaine are saying there, Vony, you get this sense of economic necessity being hugely a big driving force. Now, of course, no member of your family would have been involved in anything illegal, I'm pretty certain, Vona. And she might fit the category of cheeky Bridget, perhaps, but I don't think Ellen was quite in the bad Bridget category. But did she tell you about, I'm trying to remember from the book, did she come across perhaps those who found themselves in more difficult circumstances than she found herself in?
No, I don't think she would have encountered them, to be honest. But I have to say that I think one of the things about these young women going to America was that they left behind their safety net, their social network, and they really were on their own. So, you know, when they got to the big cities, they were presented with opportunities, some of which were good opportunities and some of which were not. And I think some of them probably saw a way to reinvent themselves without anybody looking over their shoulder. And that worked to the good in many cases, where people were able to kind of, you know, get on the economic ladder and just basically go up small rung by small rung. They never got to the top of it, but they got somewhere. But also, I think, you know, sometimes they just saw a way to make some quick money without, they thought, you know, their father and mother watching them or the priest looking at them. There was a kind of a freedom to the opportunism.
And I suppose the other side of it, it's important to point out, Elaine, that is it 86% of the female prison population in the early 1860s in New York was Irish?
Yes,
that's a phenomenal number of to make up that amount of those who are incarcerated.
It's absolutely staggering, isn't it? And you know, when we were looking at these statistics, we were completely shocked. But then we actually found the same thing in Toronto. Like in 1861 in Toronto, 83% of the female population in Toronto jail is Irish. So we can see they're in huge numbers. And I suppose there's many reasons for this, which is connected to the fact that they're more likely to be arrested because of the opportunities, as Vona has said, there's some opportunities there. There's some vulnerabilities. They're travelling on their own. The lack of support network as well, but also because they're more likely to be convicted when they get to prison. There's a lot of poverty there as well. So for some, this poverty is leading to the crime in the first place, but it also means that they're not able to pay the fines. So they're opting for prison. Yeah. Instead of paying the fines, and so they're picked up in our prison records. We also see homelessness. We see some of these Irish women are asking to go to prison. You know, they're thanking the judge when the judge sentenced them to 30 or 60 days behind bars because they've nowhere else to go. This is a guaranteed meal. We see a lot of drunkenness as well coming up. The vast majority of our bad Bridgets are in prison for drunkenness or alcohol-related crimes, and they're just so visible. We also see the kind of discrimination, like that case of Marion Cannon and that we mentioned, you know, where because she was Irish, because she was a migrant, because she was working in the sex industry, she's assumed to be guilty of the crime. So there's all these multiple factors that are influencing those high numbers.
And not everybody would have had the intelligence and the drive that Marion Canning had to go and defend herself in court. I guess, as you say, this kind of thanking the judge for 30 days or 60 days or whatever it was of at least food and shelter, perhaps in many cases. In the case of Ellen O'Hara, Vona, she did manage to make a visit back home.
Well, she did. Just to add one thing about there. So one of the ways that these Irish immigrant women had of protecting themselves from the things that Leanne and Elaine are talking about is to get jobs as domestic servants, because they were safe. And by and large, unless there was a sexual predator in the household, they were safe. They were warm, they were fed, and they were protected. So that's why I can say that somebody like Ellen probably wouldn't have really met the kind of women that are the subject there. Yes, in Ellen's case as well, and this has been raised already, it was all about money. It was all about earning money to send money back home. And that's what she spent her time doing. The life of a domestic servant was a really hard life. They worked 15-hour days, 6.5 days a week. And I did talk about making Ellen up, and I did make Ellen up, but I didn't pull her out of thin air entirely. Mm. So I did work with people who are also cited in Bad Bridget, historians of Irish women's experience. So, for example, Janet Nolan tells us this: although 2/3 of all women of working age in Ireland in 1901 had no wage earning jobs, almost 3/4 of their sisters in the United States in 1900 were earning independent livelihoods. So, you know, it's a story that can go to the bad so easily.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, what an opportunity as well that they could go from having nothing and no possibility of employment or betterment in Ireland to being able to earn independent livelihoods.
Yeah, and in fact, part of it was Ellen's two children were in Sligo at the time she came visit. They were staying with their grandparents in Sligo, which was part of the reason she would have wanted to keep that contact alive, I guess.
Yes, exactly. She brought her two children back home to South County Sligo and left them there, which is a sad story. But yeah. I think, you know, it's a sad story amongst many sad stories, really. I mean, it was all about survival, and that's what she felt she had to do in order to survive.
To what extent would the Bad Bridgets have had the opportunity, I suppose, in many ways, Leanne, to potentially make that journey back home?
We do see quite a few women who do go back and forward. There is some movement. We see some women who end up going back home. Marion Canning, actually, after she's released from prison, goes back home, and we know that she gets married, and probably nobody at home ever finds out anything about her. And we have a number of other women who we can see in the records that often after they've left prison that do return home. And we see in the records again people often wanting to return home as well, and been very keen to return home too. And I suppose just as Vona was saying about the domestic servants, we do see for some it was, as she said, an incredibly hard life. But we've seen in the records as well quite a few domestic servants who get up to no good as well, particularly for stealing. We've one example of a woman called, she was known as Little Annie Riley, and because she was so charismatic and innocent looking, that she was able to get lots of jobs as a domestic servant and actually as a nurse to children. And then what she would do is, after a few days, she would just clean the house out, and off she would go with her goods. You know, on one occasion she served dinner with a stolen dress under her clothes and wearing a hairpiece that she'd stolen, you know, and took compliments on her hair before she kind of left.
Good woman.
Legged it with all the loot from the house as well. So I suppose you do see our Bad Bridges appearing everywhere too.
Yeah, and Elaine, you know, Vona touching on the fact that in her case, in the case of Ellen O'Hara, the children were back at home in Sligo. How big a part of the story here is motherhood, and how important a factor is it in the women's stories that you uncovered?
We see this coming up quite a lot. Leaving children behind is a very common survival strategy. So whether that's bringing the children back home or whether that's leaving them at home in the first place, it's because these women need to set themselves up. So sometimes couples are going together, they set themselves up. Sometimes they bring some of the children and leave the others behind. And they send for them then months or sometimes even years later, or sometimes not at all. So we see that quite a lot. We also see pregnancy coming up quite a fair bit in these records. What we're really trying to show is the complexities of the Irish immigration story. So for many of these women, what we have now found from research that has been done in recent years is that these Irish women are becoming pregnant, and we see them then, they become pregnant in Ireland, and they're actually emigrating as a means of escaping the stigma that was attached to being pregnant outside marriage in Ireland, and then committing crimes in America, crimes like abortion, crimes like infanticide, as they did in Ireland. We can also see the burden, I suppose, of motherhood when women get to North America and they have these children. There's a need to kind of support the children, but unlimited, very limited resources. We have one example of Bridget Donnelly, who's from County Tyrone, and she says if she'd known anything about married life, she'd have remained single. And she says 9 children are too many to bear and 6 are too many to keep clothed and fed. And we see such stories of poverty. That's what I really loved about doing this project is we're telling these stories of women who commit crimes, but because the criminal records are so rich in detail about day-to-day lives, what we're actually doing is showing the wider 19th and early 20th century context in which these crimes actually happened.
And does that give you any route, I suppose, or any understanding of the current migration crisis? Do you see parallels in the stories of the women there and perhaps the stories of contemporary women, Elaine?
Yes, we can see some similarities. I suppose the idea that that women and Irish women and men went to North America, that they worked hard and they built the cities, that was very much the reality for many, but it was not the reality for all. And I think it's important to kind of recognise those complexities.
And also I think one of the things that we do see as well is the similar idea of chain migration, of somebody going first and then bringing other members of their family. You know, that's often very similar to situations today when people migrate and the factors that drive people to migrate. But also I think that we wanted to tell, again, as Elena said, that complex story, that sometimes a rosy glow can be put on immigration in the past, and you know, it can be very quick to sort of forget that things didn't often work out well for some people, and that migration story can be very difficult for people in the past and people today as well.
I was wondering if my ears were playing up on me, but you did swap from Elaine to Leanne in the middle of that.
Yes, sorry.
No, that's fine.
we come as a duo. Yeah,
the ears are still alive. And finally then to you, Vona, telling Ellen's story from back in the 19th century, what understanding did that give you of the contemporary situation?
Well, I came away with a huge admiration for these women who, you know, with very little that they took with them in material goods or in education or in support, with the very little that they took with them, you know, so many of them did actually make lives for themselves. And I just think what an incredibly creative act that was. And also, you know, we can't underestimate the trauma of the leaving home. I mean, some of them were dying to get out, I'm sure, but I think for a lot of them to be sent off so early, so young, with so little, to a place that looked so completely different to anything that they knew before and was so completely different. There might have been an excitement to it, but I think there was a cost to it as well. And I think that cost plays out in families and in family relations, sometimes over several generations.
Well, I think on the basis of what all three of you have been speaking about this evening, you add Nuala O'Connor into the mix, and the fact that, you know, Nuala has written the book Nora, which of course deals with, I suppose, one of our most famous emigres, James Joyce and Nora Barnacle, particularly from the Nora point of view, that will make for a very interesting discussion indeed, I'm sure. Thanks to all three of you for being with me this evening. That is Elaine Farrell, Leanne McCormack and Vona O'Gourke, and they will be taking part in that conversation with author Nuala O'Connor, Telling Tales, Irish Immigrant Women in the 19th Century. It's at Nuns Island Theatre at 6 p.m. Wednesday the 19th of April. That's the day after tomorrow, isn't it? Further details, full details on coorch.ie. The festival itself runs from tomorrow, the 18th of April, through until the 23rd. I don't know what's happening to your text machines out there. Let me be clear. I Feel Love was the title of the song, co-written with Giorgio Moroder. I asked you about the co-writer and the singer of the song. We have three different, we have three entries of Jimmy Somerville. I wonder, is somebody's autocorrect on overdrive? So maybe just double check, is that really what you wanted to say, Jimmy Somerville? However, we will leave that and come back to the Jenny Green concert and the singer of I Feel Love a little bit later on. Because right now, since his debut album, Small Moments, was released in 2010, David Kitt has remained one of our most interesting, intriguing and avowedly independent singer-songwriters. Latest album is called Idiot Check. Hugely positive reaction from our album reviewers a couple of weeks back when we reviewed it here on Arena. One of the observations, David, that the reviewers made on that night was this this idea that the one consistent in your music is change. That, yeah, you can't actually pin you down in terms of he's this type of singer or he's that type of musician. Do you consciously change, or is that the way it comes out, if you know what I mean?
I think it's more the latter, yeah. Mm. There's no real, I guess it's just evolution to an extent, you know. I mean, what's that Goddard thing? The best way to criticize your own work is to make your own film, is to make another film, or, yeah, you know. So it's like, I think there is an element of when you tie up one project, the best way to move on or respond to it is to make something else. And there is a sense of, I suppose, a sense of evolution, yeah. For me personally, I can feel it. But yeah, there's no grand plan at the same time.
Yeah. You know? You're going to sing a song live, and we'll play a couple of tracks off the album as we're chatting later as well. This is the final track on the album, and I wondered to what extent does a final track on the album kind of gather what you've been doing over the previous, what is it? Isn't it 10 tracks in total, yeah, in the album? On the previous 9 tracks, does it, yeah, kind of bring them all together and say, now, after the 9 of those, here's where I am now? Because I get the sense in this song that you're not in a bad place.
I think I described it like the label were very keen to have, I didn't want this track on the album initially. Oh. Even though it's actually turned out to be a lot of people's favourite songs, and it's the one I'm singing now. It's the one I've chosen to sing. But it's, they were, for me, it didn't quite work, but it almost feels to me like it's like in a film where it's like 6 months later and the suburbs have, it's spring and the suburbs, yeah, are all leafy again and life's kind of returned to normal. Or maybe it has that kind of epilogue coda effect or something. It kind of works in that way. It took me a while to accept it, and the label were very, you know, insistent that it ended, that it was on the record.
Well, the feeling I got was precisely that. That it was, yeah, a kind of a, and now, let me just tell you where I am.
Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah,
track 10, Waves of Peace. So, yeah, will we hear it? This, yes, is obviously just you and the guitar. Yeah. A little bit different from the album.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff indeed. Wave of Peace, the final song on David Kitt's current album, Idiot's Check, performed live for us in studio. And I must say, David, I'm very glad that the album the label persuaded you to put that on as the final track. And I'm even gladder that you chose it to play for us and to sing for us tonight. It's lovely to hear it in its, I mean, it's reasonably pared back on the album anyway. Yeah. It's not, you know, there are other tracks that have more kind of electronics and stuff going on in them. But that one, even on the album, has very little behind it, except the sound of the sea.
Yeah, well, that's the sea in Ballinskellig. That's Ballinskellig Beach, basically 70 seconds from my, maybe less if you're at a canter from my from where I'm living at the moment.
And so, why, yeah, did you want to live so far away from the sea, a whole 70 seconds? When was that move? When did that move come, actually? Because I can't remember, it was a couple of years back that you were in, I mean, you've been very vocal about the whole housing situation and the difficulties for people, and that was part of what sent you out of the city initially a few years back, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was, it's kind of a long story. I mean, I was supposed to be moving to Australia just before the pandemic, so I was emigrating, I'd sold my car, I'd like literally... I'd given a lot of my winter clothes to Simon Community and got rid of my books and sold half my records, and I was basically moving halfway, you know, across the world, yeah. But moving to Mars, I guess. And then COVID happened, and really it was kind of a temporary measure moving to Kerry, but things changed, I guess, in my personal life and the reasons I was going to Australia. Change of course was enforced upon me, and I ended up staying there. I'm still there. It's just been there was just a kind of reevaluation of you know, what I was looking for from life. Maybe it's like my quality of life down there is a lot higher than I suppose when I was living in Dublin, and I can afford a place where I can make a bit of noise and I can work from home, and you know, it's obviously more of a challenge now that the world's opened up again, and you know, traveling, driving from Ballinskellig, it's a bit of a hike, but it's had so many benefits.
Well, I mean, even if you look at that song, it starts with "Set Free," which you kind of get. I hear what you're saying. This idea of, you know, 6 months the epilogue to a film, 6 months later after the, you know, because it wasn't a pleasant time, I suppose, with the different things that happened in your personal life at that time. Then you get this "Set Free," but then "Standing in the Breeze," kind of. Ready to run, not run away. I don't get any sense that you're running away from anything, but that you just want to feel that breeze hitting up against you and the wave of peace rolling over you.
Yeah, it's one of those songs. It's weird. I mean, you know, there is this element of making records, and when you start doing interviews and talking about them, and you know, people try to tidy up the chronology of your life into like, this is the latest statement of where I'm at, and or is my latest diary entry or whatever. Yeah. And you know, it's the record is, I guess, some of these songs actually, Wave of Peace itself, the chorus I had knocking around maybe before a lot of this happened. Yeah. But you know, you do fill in the blanks and the mood of it and how it all ties in maybe with where I am. I can see how it makes sense to a lot of people, but it's, you know,
not necessarily how you didn't think. Now I'll write the song to finish my album.
100%, yeah, it doesn't really work that way. Yeah,
tell me a little bit about "All Folly," which I particularly like on the album as well. Just tell me a bit about it.
Well, that one did really come from my time in Kerry. That was very myself and the Irish writer Kevin Barry worked on a piece called "Cornelina." I don't know if we were on to you on the, maybe we were on from Kerry at one point when that came out. It was part of Music Town, which was an online festival, very COVID related.
Yeah.
We'd been working on it for a couple of years together, and Kevin would come into my studio and I'd be kind of jamming out musical ideas, and he would do these amazing, you know, improvised short story things. And so that was a kind of a leftover from that. And then inspired by one of his stories, and the Irish parts maybe came from hanging out with the folk singer, Carys Irvine folk singer Sean Garvey, who sadly passed away last year and had become a really good friend of mine. So I can really hear his voice in that song a lot. And then Mary Margaret O'Hara, obviously, who's a real serious legend and hero of mine in her own right, made it really massive record in '89, Miss America.
I have it playing underneath us here. So yeah. I just want to bring it up because your vocals have just come in, because there's the couple of focal in here.
Just the couple of focal, yeah.
Let's have a listen. Let's have a listen. That's true. I wanted people to recognise that the couple of focal were in there. I was asking you before we came to air tonight, David, that's David Kitt and "All Folly" from the new album, Idiot Check. I was asking you, you know, has Irish been a part of your songwriting up to this, or do you think this is a kind of sprung out of the Kerry thing as well, obviously out of that experience you were talking about as well?
I think it did, yeah. I think hanging out with Sean Garvey, and he would often throw in, he's very amazing way with language and kind of multilingual, you know, plays on words, and hanging out with him was very inspiring in that regard. So I think it filtered through from that. It's, you know, you know, I went to the Gwell. I was actually, someone who was at my concert in Whelans on Saturday was asking me if I was ever going to cover a Fog All Slán Ag Ban an Tí, which was the song we were all taught to get the tears flowing when we were all saying goodbye at the
to
end.
To the Banatí,
you
know? And the
Because it was to the tune of MASH, the theme music from MASH. Ag Fog All Slán Ag Ban an Tí, Mo Wally Ray Is Mé Ag Cuí. You know, anyway, it was a real tearjerker. But it's been there since I was a kid. But I'm not in any way fluent. But and it's kind of shameful that I've spent 2.5 years in the Gaeltacht area. But it's starting to come through.
Well, it slips in there, and it slips in so naturally. It's just great. So, you know, I suppose in the way that you do these things, it'll come when it's ready to come. Yeah. You're not gonna force that unless you've changed personality in the last few years. I want to finish up by playing a little bit of Wexford Strawberries. It's such an evocative, even just when you say Wexford Strawberries, I think for many people, you're immediately in the summer and you're travelling somewhere, you know, with the signs on the side of the road, Wexford Strawberries. Maybe give me a little bit of what fed into this song, because there's a wonderful nostalgia in it, but there's a sadness in here as well, I think.
Yeah, I think maybe this was one that has an autobiographical element, and I think, you know, it was something that was genuinely started before COVID, when life was one way, and then, you know, and my, you know, the relationship I was in ended really as a result of COVID, or partly to do with that, and it was, you know, this was in some ways at the height of those feel, you know, reminiscing on a kind of almost like a past life, and then kind of how it, you know, you take this snapshot from your past and where you end up, and then it kind of, I think it's quite a filmic kind of song, the way it's kind of bookended by the same verse, and this, and the drama happens in the middle and you return to that scene at the end. But it was, again, sometimes you're just following a rhyme for inspiration, and that came, you know, strawberries happen to rhyme with the and you're going, oh my God, this is the scene, it's perfect, you know.
And off you went to the now you played Whelans, you know, at the weekend. Must be great to be back out there, and you're on the road now basically from the rest of this month and most of the next month, I think, as well, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. We're just announcing tomorrow another couple of Whelans shows at Christmas, because that one sold out and there's a lot of people trying to get in, which is great. I haven't been able to say that for a while, so if they're all on davidkitt.com and all the
great
dates.
Okay, well, let's listen. We'll finish up by listening to a bit of Wexford Strawberries. Thanks for making the trip up to us.
Thanks, Sean.
And back you go, and you do your 70-second commute down to the sea tomorrow. Not jealous at all, as you can hear. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers, Sean.
Just to whet your appetite with the opening stanza there, the opening verse of Wexford Strawberries from David Kitt. The current album called Idiot's Check. He's on tour, as David told you, around Ireland and the UK for the rest of April and May. And you will get full details of all of the dates and venues on davidkitt.com, and that announcement of the Whelans gigs in and around Christmas time. Well, who better to introduce you than the voice of John Kavanagh that we heard during that ad break, who indeed talking about One Dublin, One Book, and indeed talking about Andrew Hughes, the coroner's daughter. Delighted that Andrew is with me in studio now. We were chatting just before, during that ad break, Andrew, about when you were in. I couldn't remember whether you were actually in or was it a COVID-ish situation, but it was 2017.
That's right.
You were in and you were talking about the coroner's daughter, which goes right back to 1816. Terrible time, terrible weather, wasn't there, in the city, in Dublin at the time, and the 18-year-old Abigail Lawless. Had you kind of put the book to bed when the One City, One Dublin, One Book, rather, came into being?
It's true, yeah. So the book came out in 2017. And there's kind of the sense that, you know, a book has its day. It's in the limelight for a few months or whatever, you know, it's seen in the shops. And so for 6 years later to get this nod from UNESCO City of Literature and One Dublin, One Book that you're the choice for 2023, it's something that I've been conscious of, this initiative. You see it every year. Mm. You see the books on, you know, banners on lampposts outside the GPO. You see the big billboards. And I always thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice now if one of my books was chosen? And then out of the blue, I got the nod. So, yeah, it's just so wonderful to be able to revisit the book after so much time, and to revisit it with such a sense of celebration with all these fantastic events that have been put on, and just to explore the different themes in certain nights.
What I remember most about the book from back when I read it back at that time, back in would have been 2017 or thereabouts, was the atmosphere of the city that it really paints for us through this character of Abigail Lawless. Because am I right? It came out of, in fact, a non-fiction book that you had written previous to that. Wasn't that the kind of, or a character that you'd come across?
That was my first novel. So my first book was a social history of Fitzwilliam Square. I researched the history of Georgian houses. And my first book, I looked at all 69 houses of Fitzwilliam Square. And my first novel came out of a character that I discovered through that research. She was John Delahunt, a true life Victorian murderer and Dublin Castle informer. And so my first novel was The Convictions of John Delahunt. And then after just being in the head
that
of
world.
This amoral killer, which was fun at times, you know, and you could explore the darker side of life. I just knew that for my next novel, I wanted the main character to be the hero. I wanted her to be a young woman. And since she'd need plausible access to cases of murder, just the idea of the coroner's daughter just popped into my head. So
Abigail Lawless is the coroner's daughter. And Daddy is not at all pleased with her interest in his job, is he?
Well, he's indulgent to an extent. He appreciates that his daughter is intuitive, is, you know, intelligent, and has this certain interest. He's also conscious that she's a young woman in Regency Dublin, and he is conscious of her reputation and this reputation that she might get for having a fixation with macabre interests. So there's always this battle, which I suppose goes on to the present day, of keeping her daughter on the straight and narrow, but also indulging her own passions and interests.
And tell me about the weather in 1816, because it's certainly a big part of the novel, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it was my way in. I'd come across this huge eruption of a mountain called Tambora in Indonesia in 1815. I believe it's the biggest eruption in recorded history. And it just sent this huge dust cloud over the Northern Hemisphere, Western Europe, North America, and created these conditions that then became called the Year Without a Summer, because this dust cloud just turned the sun blood
famously
red.
Famously, Turner's watercolors are
exactly
a visual version of that.
Yeah, it's this strange effect on the light. And so I just looked at that and said, this is a fantastic eerie atmosphere for some gothic crime fiction. And so I decided to set the book in the year 1816. That was the reason for that. And then 1816, also by coincidence, a book was published called The Epitome of Forensics. This surgeon called George Mayle was aghast at how little medical science was being used in coroner's inquests and in murder trials. And he said, I'm going to put this right by putting together this textbook of what to do when you discover a body. What are the signs of certain types of wounds and weapons? What are the tests for establishing poisons? And it was this perfect snapshot of where forensics was in 1816. And because of the coincidence, I was setting the book there anyway. It became my textbook for Abigail.
And Abigail is obviously, she is the young woman that leads us right through it. I'm trying to find here the name of the rather nasty kind of cultish group that's involved in the plot as well.
Yeah, they are called the Brethren.
The Brethren, that's them.
That came again from my Fitzwilliam Square book, because there is a group called the Plymouth Brethren. They are still existing in, I think, in Northern Ireland and in North America. Their first meetings took place in Fitzwilliam Square. Their first meetings in Britain took place in Plymouth. So that's where the name Plymouth Brethren came from. And very roughly, I based my evangelical group on the Brethren. There are certain differences. Their leader was also called Mr. Darby, who is the antagonist for Abigail in my book. They just seem the perfect, you know, conservative antagonists for this spiky, headstrong young woman.
It's such a great period in terms of, you know, when you think of that mix of the kind of the superstition that was still there and that Gothic quality and yet big scientific advances, even as you're talking about the forensics, that book that, that you mentioned in there. There's a real televisual aspect to this.
Well, I'd love that. You know, if RTE want to put together an adaptation,
you're
I'd
happy.
Be all for it, yeah.
Because I remember at the time too, I think I may have said it to you at the time, are we going to hear more of Abigail?
Well, yes, the book ends with definite prospects for a sequel. And it is really because of this one Dublin boost, I've decided that the time has come. And so I've begun writing the second Coroner's Daughter novel. And hopefully, I would love it if Abigail became a recurring character in crime fiction, Irish crime fiction. And I'd love her to be part of a series of books.
Yeah, and is there a particular event within one Dublin one book that you're looking forward to?
Well, they've been so brilliant so far. We've had one in the Royal Irish Academy, the Botanic Gardens, the National Library only on Saturday. Our main event is in the Hugh Lane on Thursday with Niall McMonagle. So it's just been a joy as well to visit branch libraries for the smaller events and readers clubs and so on, and to get the perspective of readers on the book, things that I wouldn't have thought about or really have.
And do you wear your Wexford jersey when you go to those libraries?
One of the best things we had was a link up with Wexford libraries. We brought one Dublin on the road, brought it home to Wexford, and with Kat Hogan and Caroline Busher, we had one of our best readers' nights.
Well, there you go. Yes, and there is no rule that says that you can't be from Wexford and write a book about Dublin. So
it was lovely listening to David Kitt playing Wexford Strawberries.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, there you go. It was just for you. Did you not know? Listen, thanks a million for coming into us. That's The Coroner's Daughter by Andrew Hughes, published by Penguin, and it is the One Dublin One Book selection for 2023. For full details on One Dublin One Book. .ie. Yes, competition winner for this evening. Hey, Jimmy Somerville. No, he didn't sing it. Blondie. No, didn't sing it. Annie Lennox. No, didn't sing it. I'm not going to go for that one. Gloria Gaynor. No, didn't sing it. Don't know who. What was you? Donna Summer was the person who sang I Feel Love. And the winner of tonight's competition is Kieran Eaton from Dungarvan, in nearby in County Waterford, isn't it, that Dungarvan is in. So there you go. Congratulations to you, Kieran, and enjoy the event indeed and your overnight stay as well. That is our lot for this evening. Polly Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Amandine Passo-Devine was the broadcast coordinator. Ashton Grufferty was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Ola McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock once again here on RTE Radio 1. John Green will be with you after the news.